Thank you, Dr. Waller. We have time for some questions from the audience. While the ushers collect questions written on the yellow cards, let me begin by asking, how have the former combatants in Northern Ireland shared their experience in other pre- and post-conflict societies?
How have they shared them to those societies?
Yes. Have you seen any instances of people who've been through this terribly difficult process working in other countries mm-hmm. which are going through similar processes?
No, that's a good question. I think Northern Ireland has a lot to teach other post-conflict societies about how to recover from conflict, the best steps forward. I think issues of perpetrators in Northern Ireland, I think one of the most dangerous things you can do and ask in Northern Ireland, what's the definition of a victim? What's the definition of a perpetrator? Because one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And even now, we're trying to get reparations for victims of the Troubles, but many families in Northern Ireland say, well, the only victims of the Troubles could be Protestants. There can be no Catholic victims of the Troubles, and we won't support reparations unless that is acknowledged. So I think there are certainly things where we've tried to transport some understandings of how we try to reconcile after conflict, but I think there are also, and this is one of the challenges of conflict studies, there are so many things unique to the Northern Ireland context that many times it's hard to transport out and hard to transport in. So for instance, and then we'll get to the next question, one of the things people always want to push Northern Ireland to do is to have a truth commission, because the truth commission fixed South Africa. That's actually a pretty limited understanding of what the truth commission did in South Africa, and South Africans will tell you it hasn't been what the world thinks it's been. There has not been a truth commission in Northern Ireland. There'll never be a truth commission in Northern Ireland. It's just not something that's possible to pull off in a society with the deep divisions it has. So they have to find other ways forward of dealing with the past, and I think that's really the significant challenge in the country.
Thank you. Can you speak some, you've certainly elaborated on the risk. You also spoke about some of the resilience that you've seen in Northern Ireland, just the fact that people are still, after 20 years, living by the accord. Is resilience an attribute you've seen in all of the societies you've studied in post-conflict?
Yeah, I think one of the things we look at in post-conflict societies is what are the, and I'm predisposed to risk, because that's what I'm looking for, is for the areas of concern. But certainly societies can find resilient things to build in terms of governance, economy, social fragmentation, and how they interpret their history and so on. And I think Northern Ireland has done that. And again, I do want to give credit to Northern Ireland for it's 20 years on, and while there's still random outbreaks of violence, nothing has returned like what the Troubles were. And there's credit to be given for that. So I do think there are points of resilience that internally can be built up. And Northern Ireland has done well with some pieces of that, but there are other parts of it that I think still are more at risk than that.
Jim, could you speak a little more, elaborate on the impact that Brexit will have mm-hmm. if it's fully implemented, or that it could have?
Yeah. No, I think our general fear with Brexit that will, and I'd say every person I talked to did not hesitate, they said this will bring back violence, is that if Brexit means that the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland leaves the EU, which is the heart of Brexit and which they've pushed off now into October, if that happens, there will have to be a hard physical border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Right now, I fly into Dublin. I get on a bus, I go to Belfast. There's no stop. I mean, there's no stop at a border because there really is no border for any practical purposes. I know I've entered Northern Ireland when I see the British flags and so on, but there's no border you have to cross through. Every day, about 30,000 people make their living working across that border. If that becomes a hard border with passport control, with security controls, that hard border is going to be attacked by nationalists. it will be the subject of violence. I mean, it's just not a question. It's going to be attacked. The question is going to be, how much does that violence rise? How much does it start to dissipate throughout society? So I think the key issue with Brexit is going to be the border. Some people have said with Brexit, the border is going to be the Irish Sea. It's not going to lead to less violence, because then loyalist paramilitaries are going to say, we don't want a border between us and our British identity. That border is not going to work for us either. So the border issue, I think, is what's going to inflame the most tensions about Brexit. Already, the looming nature of Brexit has already been devastating for the Northern Ireland economy. I mean, it was just starting to gain strength, but now companies are pulling out because they're unsure what Brexit's going to do to it. And again, the unfairness of Brexit in Northern Ireland, and it gets both sides angry, is that we didn't vote for it. None of us as a majority said this is what we wanted, but now we're stuck with it because some, and Scotland says the same. We're stuck with it now because a lot of people in England voted for it, and its effect will be felt in all the constituent countries, but it will be devastating for Northern Ireland.
Thank you, Jim. When you were in Ireland, did you meet couples or families who were raised in both the Protestant and Catholic communities? And if so, how do they make life work?
Yeah, this is the phenomenon of what are called mixed marriages. And it just, you know, I'm a child of the South. And I grew up in the South in a time when you talked about mixed marriages, it was black-white. And everyone always said about mixed marriages, it's hard on the kids. Even if it's legal, it's hard on the kids. And you didn't see a lot of people pursuing mixed marriages because of all the stuff that surrounded it. It's amazing to be in Northern Ireland and hear people talk about mixed marriages. And what they're talking about is Protestant and Catholic. We don't even tend to see those big distinctions in the US, but in Northern Ireland, these are definitory. The number of mixed marriages in Northern Ireland is less than 2% of all state-recognized marriages. People just don't do it very often. When they do it, they have support groups for people who are in mixed marriages. I mean, that's what it takes. I'm thinking of one person in particular, a mental health expert I talked to, who was Protestant, he had married a Catholic, and neither family, this is a well-educated person from well-educated families, neither family talked to either of them. Both of them have been disowned by their family because they were in a mixed marriage. And he told me, and it was just like going back to 1960s here, he said to me, they keep telling us how worried they are about our kids, because our kids won't know who they are and people will make fun of our kids. So the small number of mixed marriages and the supports that have to be offered for people in mixed marriages, they really help you understand. And I love Rory McIlroy as a golfer, but when he says, it doesn't matter which side of the street you come from, I've met very, very, very few people in Northern Ireland who'd say, maybe it doesn't matter for his street, because it's a pretty wealthy street. For most people in Northern Ireland, which side of the street you come from matters a great, great deal in a lot of ways.
You mentioned higher education and the lack of job opportunities for Protestants. Is it the same for Catholics? And if not, why?
Yeah, that's been an interesting pattern. Remember when I talked to you about by 1968, Catholics were upset because they didn't have the same human and civil rights Protestants had. The Catholic response to that persecution was, get educated. If we go on to university, we get a degree, that has to open doors for us. So within Catholic communities in Northern Ireland, higher education is an expectation of what Catholic young men and women will do. And it's an expectation that they will not only get the degree, but they will stay in Northern Ireland and they will stay in their communities and make that community a better place. Protestants, as I said earlier, particularly young boys, always had the option of taking the jobs that their fathers had at the local factory, the shipyard, shipbuilding yard. That was an option. So higher education wasn't prized. And so what happens today in the Protestant community is you have this cultural recognition that higher education isn't prized. And the Protestant young men and women who go on to get higher education almost always go to England for that, and very seldom come back. So it becomes a cyclical problem. The Protestant communities, and they admit this, don't value higher education. When they do get it, they go over there to get it, and they stay over there. They don't come back to the communities they came from. So the educational attainment difference between Catholic and Protestant is huge in Northern Ireland. And what it's meant for Protestant communities, both for young boys and young girls growing up in those communities, is very, very few outlets for what they could do, other than work at the local mall, work at the local fish and chip shop. They just don't see the opportunities for employment that their Catholic peers see.
One last question, Jim.
Okay.
Have you ever spoken to or met George Mitchell? I don't even know if he's still alive.
He is still alive.
And how does he see today's situation, as far as you know?
I've not had the pleasure of being able to meet Senator Mitchell. I've read everything he's written about Northern Ireland and the peace agreements. I've met dozens of people in Northern Ireland who met him. And again, he is outside of John Kennedy for the Catholic community. George Mitchell is the most highly revered American, really, in both sides of the communities in Northern Ireland. I haven't heard him speak or write recently about it, although just this past week, with the British Open in Northern Ireland, he was interviewed, and he basically said what people have to remember is that the death toll of 3,500 was no measure of the trauma that was inflicted on this society. It was widespread. And he said people have to remember the fragility of the peace. So he knew how difficult it was to bring that peace about. And I think my perception is, again, just from a few things I've seen written about him and that he's spoken, is he recognizes the fragility of the peace. And I'll finish here with what I said earlier. Most peace agreements don't make 5 years. This one's made 20. That's great news. But anyone who tells you the peace process is over, everything's great, everything's good going forward, it's not that. This peace is a fragile thing. And there are a lot of pieces of fragility in Belfast and in Northern Ireland that I think really call that peace process into question. And I think for me, the most important thing I've learned from Northern Ireland is when I came there, one of the questions in interviews I often ask was, what does it feel like, or you know, how do you see these things occurring in a post-conflict society? And again, people stop me often with that one, so I don't even say it anymore. And they said, there's nothing post-conflict about this society. The conflict is just different than it used to be. It's not street fighting, it's not the violence. The conflict is now political. We're not really post-conflict. And I look at other countries in the world, and I even look at my own. And I say this in the preface to my book that I'm still writing on Northern Ireland, that as someone coming from the US, we do and we should understand what it means to live in a deeply divided society. That we should and we do understand that we really live in a post-conflict society that we may not be able to describe as post-conflict. We don't know if we've really come to grips with the Civil War, with the founding of a country on the extermination of one people and the enslavement of another people. I don't know to what degree we can call ourselves post-conflict, but I'm sure Northern Ireland is unfortunately not in a position at this point to call itself post-conflict either.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Our program next Sunday will feature Rick Van Wickler, Superintendent of the Cheshire County Department of Corrections, who will be speaking on the American correctional system, or is it?